wonderful I felt. And this is the third year that I've taught that retreat there. And it seems that as we do it, just there's some certain kind of maturity that happens. Maybe the first year I did it, I was kind of a new teacher. And so people didn't know me very much. So a lot of people who came were new students. But a lot of people keep coming back over the years. And so now they're not new students anymore. And I'm not a new teacher anymore. So there's a kind of a maturation that I felt there. It was a very nice feeling, very stable and quite committed. Didn't have some of the rough, I didn't feel like I had some of the rough edges we've had the first couple of years. And so we celebrated New Year's Eve there. Because we ended Sunday. So Saturday evening we stayed up until midnight, until 12:05. And maybe we could have, it was very still, maybe we could have sat longer, but I'm still conditioned by the first year where we stayed up until midnight. And at 12:02, I thought we'd sit for 15, 20 minutes into the new year. At 12:02, there was all this restlessness. It was obvious that people. So I said, well, so we stopped at 12:05. And I wanted to start off, I wanted to say a little bit about, I guess, take off on a talk kind of on New Year's, the idea of New Year's a little bit. One of the things that I've said each year that I've done that retreat, and I said this year, is that there's a way to understand that New Year's doesn't exist. And it was quite a relief for some people there. They come and told me afterwards it was kind of a relief to hear that. And I talked about how, I think it's Joseph Goldstein, maybe in one of his books or somewhere, talks about this, he met a woman who described to him, told him the story of traveling, I think somewhere between Iran and Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or someplace, taking a bus or a car or something, and crossing this huge, expansive kind of desert-like plateau. And it's just nothing, you're just for miles and miles and miles. And you're driving down this road, and then suddenly you come to a border crossing, and there's a little gate with two little guardhouses on either side. You know, and someone's there waiting at the gate, and they open the gate. And you go off, you know, you go through and they close the gate, and just all this, and there's just, you could easily drive around. And the person realized how arbitrary these borders were and how... at least some borders, I guess, follow natural contours, but that this some borders between countries and whatever are only exist in the mind. That they don't exist in real, you know, they don't exist out there, and we fight wars over it, and we're fighting wars over things that exist in the mind. And so in a sense, the borders in some real sense don't exist. And so New Year's Eve, New Year's is the same kind of event. It doesn't even make any sense to have it when we do it, in the sense there's no particular astrological event that's happening New Year's Eve. It may make more sense to have it on the solstice or in the spring or the equinox or who knows. But we just have, I don't know why we come up with this particular date. There must be a reason. And our calendar doesn't even reflect it, right? Because December means a 10th month. It's supposed to be 12 months, and December means a 10th month. It used to be the New Year's was in March. But New Year's is kind of like that. It exists in our collective mind, in our cultural mind. And Bay Area being such a culturally diverse place, you can go around and celebrate New Year's many times of the year if you're into it. And so that's where it exists. It exists somehow as a construct that our culture or our cultural minds or in our minds. And so it doesn't really exist. However, you don't want to... and so you have some choice about whether you participate in it to some degree. And the fact that it doesn't exist kind of in a real world doesn't mean that we just kind of necessarily dispense with it. It has some value, and some of the value is that it's an event which can tie people together. It's kind of it's potentially a community. When a collective people share a particular event or a ritual or ceremony, one of the things it does is bring people together. It creates community. And So I talked about that Saturday evening, about how it doesn't exist, but this thing that doesn't exist, we use it as an excuse to create a little bit of a collective community, a community. And some people came up to me afterwards and said that they normally don't like New Year's at all. Actually, a lot of people have told me that now. They don't like New Year's. And they don't like the kind of things that happen usually in New Year's. But somehow, the way I stated it, that it was doesn't exist, but that we're using it as an excuse to make community, made sense for them, and so they felt that they wanted to participate, and it had some meaning for them. So we had a little ritual before New Year's, where we chanted the refuge and the precepts. And when Buddhists get together, whenever they have a special event, they use it as an excuse to chant the precepts and the refuge. So it creates a community, and one of the questions is what kind of community does it create? And probably it's a different kind of community that is created in Times Square in New York, as created in a meditation retreat where we've known each other intimately, in a sense, for a week. So we have these events, and then we have some choice about the kind of community, the kind of relationships we form with each other. And this is a footnote, I guess, to talk about things that don't really exist. This week I read an excerpt from a book by Tocqueville, who studied America in the 1830s, a Frenchman. And at some point he says, in America they have this new word which is gaining currency. And the new word is individualism. And so the word individualism, which seems so important, bedrock for American culture, is only about 160 years old. What do they do before that? And where does it exist, the idea of individualism? And Tocqueville said he was worried about it, because he found that individualism tended to isolate people. And he felt he was studying democracy to see how democracy worked. And the more isolated people are, the less democracy works, he felt. And he felt that as people became more and more isolated because of individualism, potentially, he said that despots can get control over people. And some people would argue that we didn't end up with despots exactly, but we ended up with advertisement or...
Violence.
Oh, sure, violence and many things. But I think like advertisements is often works very well, or political propaganda or many things work. Better, people are isolated, don't talk with each other. So individualism is also, Buddhism says at least, that the notion of self is also belongs to the same realm of existence as New Year's Eve. Not to be discounted, of course. Like New Year's Eve, we don't discount New Year's Eve. So New Year's Eve is also a time for resolutions. And so I was delighted, I like Calvin so much. So some of you probably read Calvin this morning. And Hobbes says, what are you doing? How are you doing on your New Year's resolutions? I didn't make any. And Calvin continues, see, in order to improve oneself, one must have some idea of what's good. That implies certain values. But as we all know, values are relative. Every system of belief is equally valid, and we need to tolerate diversity. Virtue isn't better than vice. It's just different. And then Hobbes says, I don't know if I can tolerate that much tolerance. And Calvin says, I refuse to be victimized by notions of virtuous behavior. And then... And actually, I liked it for various reasons. First, I liked it because Calvin's so funny, and then I reread it again, and I think that was actually quite wise, especially from a Buddhist point of view. I refuse to be victimized by notions of virtuous behavior, and I think Buddhism tries to teach that too. And again, I forgot to at the retreat. I was going to read a quote, and I showed up. I was going to start the talk on this quote. And I showed up, and the talk wasn't here. The quote wasn't there. And here I was going to read the same quote today, and I looked, and it's a monk was sick in the time of the Buddha, and the Buddha went to visit him, and the Buddha said, this is what Buddhas say when they visit the sick. The Buddha will say, is your suffering increasing or decreasing? And the monk said, oh, it's increasing. And the Buddha said, I don't remember exactly, but the Buddha said something like, do you feel guilt and remorse? And the monk said, yes. And the Buddha said, well, have you done any moral transgressions? And the monk says, no. And the Buddha says, well, how do you feel guilt and remorse? It's probably a bad translation of the Pali, but how do you feel guilt and remorse if you had no moral transgressions? And the monk said, as I understand your teachings, you don't teach this practice in order for people to attain purity of virtue. And the Buddha said, no. What do I teach? And he said, you teach this practice to attain for the purpose of relinquishment of clinging. And the Buddha said, that's right, you got it. And thereby he gave him a wonderful discourse on impermanence, and the monk was felt a lot better. And there's and the Buddha also often warned people not to get too concerned about, excessively concerned about virtue, about ethics, that the not to cling and be fanatic about ethics. He talked a lot about ethics and the importance of having ethical foundation for the practice. You can't really do the practice without a strong ethical foundation. But what he insisted is not the end all of the practice. It's not the purpose of the practice. And you don't want to be victimized by this kind of notion of notions of virtuous behavior. That there's another purpose to the practice. And this idea of relativism, which is so important in the West right now, and what Calvin is kind of referring to, as we all know, values are relative. Every system of belief is equally valid. We need to tolerate diversity. In some ways, I think the Buddha probably would have agreed to some degree. But Buddhism does offer, within the Buddhist system, some kind of ultimate value by which to measure your life on and just make your decisions on. And that ultimate value is not a belief system. It's not a system of virtue or behavior or dogma or something, but rather it's the taste or the flavor of having a what's called the sure heart's release, of experience of a heart or the mind being free of all clinging. And that sense of freedom from all clinging and the compassion that comes from that is used as the measuring stick for how to make decisions for what kind of belief systems you want to have, what kind of notions you form, and what kind of behavior and what kind of practices you do. So that's what Buddhism offers. It doesn't offer an ultimate belief system, but it offers some kind of ultimate experience. And some people would say it's experience of health or sanity or maturity. But the sure heart's release. Release or freedom, kind of a... to be set free, the experience of being free. And so that comes to the question of resolutions, which is what we're supposed to do in our culture on New Year's Eve, is make resolutions for the year. And there's lots of cartoons about the problems people have around resolutions. And further down the page, there was Loann, who made all these resolutions, and then her friend was just in hysterics reading them. And then says, finally reading them all louder and louder, her friend says, those were great. Not those are great. It's the first day. And then we make resolutions, and then we make it through a day or two of that, or a month of that. And then people feel bad because they've broken the resolutions, or they haven't. All this anxiety arises because the resolutions didn't work. You know, I apologize to those people maybe who don't like word origins, but since I like them a lot, the word resolution comes from the root is the word solve. Like, and the word solve is found, for example, in dissolve and solvent. And the root of solve means to set free or to loosen, to untie. So a resolution, perhaps, is related to this idea of setting something free, to untie, to loosen. And I think of awakening or enlightenment itself is experienced as this kind of as often experienced as release, as something being set free. And I think in a way that enlightenment or awakening comes from a combination of release and mindfulness and release. And then I was reminded that the first spiritual teaching that I got that kind of had a big impact on me was from this man named Stephen Gaskin. And he had this peculiar teaching which really made a big impact on me that when I was 20. Maybe you have to be 20 for this to be. And that is, he talked about what he called the insoluble nature of the universe. I don't know what it's exactly supposed to mean, but the way he described it was everything, every moment, everything starts new. That there's a complete new beginning every moment. And I thought that was really great. And to some degree, Buddhism says that also. However, Buddhism says that also. However, there's such a powerful conditioning factor from the previous moment that what's new in the new moment has been shaped by the previous moment. But the previous moment doesn't continue. But everything starts fresh, moment by moment. So I lived with that for many years, this notion that everything starts fresh. And it somehow made my life a lot easier. And whether you believe it completely or not, this idea, I think it's a little bit dangerous idea, maybe even. But it's so easy to discount too much then. But I think to a large degree, much of our life, much of our reality is reinvented or recreated moment by moment. And you find that yourself with having a lot less grief if you live a little bit more in that notion that things are brand new, completely new. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know what you've carried with you. We don't know it's a mystery, the next moment. One of the things that Buddhism talks a lot about is the notion of self, and particularly the notion of me and mine, clinging to notions of me and mine, what is mine. And the idea that there's no self in Buddhism kind of could imply that means there's nothing which is mine. There's nothing which is you or that you possess or have. However, it could be argued that the only thing that you really possess, the only thing which is really you in a sense, is your intention. And Buddhism puts tremendous emphasis on intention. Or maybe intention and your bad habits. Chogyam Trungpa was asked, what gets reborn? And he said, it's your bad habits. And if you've studied the Buddhist technical description of how rebirth happens, it's kind of that's shorthand for how it happens. It's your bad habits. But the bad habits also arise out of intention. And good habits also arise out of intention. Actually, he wasn't quite right. The technical description of how rebirth happens says it's from your habits. It can be both your good habits and your bad habits. And the idea is to somehow be free of all habits. And one way, we want to substitute habits with intention. And so Buddhism puts tremendous focus on intention. much more on intention than results. And the whole notion of karma that Buddhism talks about is different from the Indian notion of karma. The Indian general Indian notion of karma is that there's kind of a one-to-one, there's kind of a mechanical law of karma, and that everything you do is a result of your karma, and it's all actions lead to karma or karma causing. Buddhism modified that by said that karma is only created by your intentional actions, by actions that are supported by your intentions. That if you do an action without intention, it doesn't create any karma. And that intention continues to operate in the realm of karma, in the mechanisms of karma, continuously. In the sense that if you do something now, then there might be karmic consequences tomorrow. But the karmic consequences tomorrow are influenced by the intention that you bring to that event tomorrow. So for example, if I rob a bank today, tomorrow I might feel guilty. And that's kind of a karmic result of robbing the bank today. If I then feel a lot of self-hate and self-remorse and go out and get drunk because of how I feel, that's intensifying the karma, in a sense, the karmic results. So how we receive and how we respond to the results of the continuity of consequences is influenced by how we receive it. See, does it make sense what I'm saying? So intention is important both in creating karma and in creating the results of karma. So resolution. So resolution from a Buddhist point of view is related to intention, maybe. And someone said, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So in Buddhism, the point in Buddhism also you can make intentions and make resolutions, but the point, and maybe it's very important in some sense to, but it isn't to make it. It isn't to take an external resolution or an external intention and kind of impose it on your life, and then have it broken after a month and then feel guilty and bad. The idea in Buddhism is to pay careful attention to what is of deepest aspiration for you. What is your deepest intention for you? And that could be, each one of you will probably have a different one. And there's a whole, you know, the generic one would be to be free, or to be loving, or to be compassionate. But what is it, how does that translate for you in your own words, in your own heart, in your own life? And what is your own intention? What is your deepest intention? And everybody has a deepest intention. And it, sometimes it's covered up, and you have to kind of spend some time uncovering it. And it might be that your deepest intention today is to uncover your deepest intention. You feel that there is something and you want to spend time uncovering it. Or you might find it. And it could be a whole range. It isn't to say that it even has to be religious or spiritual, but there's something which is your particular deepest intention. And then you want to see, once you discover what that is, then you want to find how to align your life with that. You want to see if you can harmonize your life with that, or follow. Let your life be an expression of that, or let that flower in your life. So it's not something you're imposing on yourself, but it's something you're setting free. It's a release. It's a dissolving, or you're putting it into the solution or something. So practice is the solvent. And one of the things practice dissolves, it dissolves the bad habits, but it also dissolves or resolves. It's a solvent for our life, for our intention. And Sangha, community, which is one of the things that we can create around ceremonies like New Year's Eve, is a great support. It's a support. It's a very important support for letting us find a way to align our life by our deepest intention. thought I would read this quote because it's a I think it's a beautiful story by Anthony DiMello, who writes beautiful stories, spiritual stories. It's a beautiful story in its own right, but what I was thinking about it today is that it expresses someone's I think deepest intention. And it's an example of what someone's deepest intention can, how someone's deepest intention can be expressed. A devotee knelt to be initiated into discipleship. The guru whispered the sacred mantra into his ear, warning him not to reveal it to anyone. "What will happen if I do?" asked the devotee. Said the guru, "Anyone to whom you reveal the mantra will be liberated from bondage of ignorance and suffering, but you yourself will be excluded from discipleship and suffer damnation." No sooner had he heard those words than the devotee rushed into the marketplace, collecting a large crowd around him, and repeated the sacred mantra to all for all to hear. The disciples later reported this to the guru and demanded that the man be expelled from the monastery for his disobedience. The guru smiled and said, "He has no need of anything I can teach. His actions has shown him to be a guru in his own right." So this is an intention. This man had this intention. He didn't care about himself in a way. There's a way in which his deepest intention, I think probably in a healthy way since he was had become a guru, his intention was to act out of compassion. And he probably was freed from notions of heaven and hell, or freedom and damnation. When I sat down to sit this evening, I was kind of inspired at the time for us to chant the refuge and the precepts as a way of starting the year. And then I went through my mind about how I usually don't want to do that Monday evening, that kind of level of ritual or ceremony, because there's many people who come here who aren't interested in that and were kind of turned off by that. And I very much want to let this space here be a place that people who feel that mindfulness practice is supportive of them and their deepest intention or their interest, who might feel it's a useful place for them, but would be turned off by anything that was too religious. But maybe that's okay for once a year. And we accommodate them and they accommodate us at times. And so if you don't want to join in, you can sit quietly and listen. And those of you who would like to join in, you can join some chanting. So you can take comfortable posture. And in a way that needs to be personalized for each person, the taking the refuges and taking the precepts is an expression of the intention of a Buddhist. So how we'll chant them is, since many people don't know them, I thought we could do it word by word. And I'll say one word, and then you can follow. And we do it in three parts. It's all be in Pali, the ancient Buddhist language. And the first one is just simply evocation of, or paying reverence, respect to the Buddha. Just listing his various names and epithets. And the second one will be the refuges. Actually, we'll do that also in Pali. And then the precepts, because I don't know the Pali so well, we'll do in English, which is probably better anyway. I know what we're saying. So please repeat. Oh, and the precepts in English we'll do phrase by phrase rather than word by word.
Namo.
Namo.
Vyasa
Bhagavato
Arahato
Samma
Sam.
It's one word.
Samma
Sambuddhasa.
Samma
Sambuddhasa.
Namo.
Tassa
Bhagavato
Arahato
Samma Sambuddhasa.
Samma Sambuddhasa.
Namo.
Namo.
Tassa.
Tassa.
Bhagavato.
Bhagavato.
Arahato.
Arahato.
Samma Sambuddhasa.
Samma Sambuddhasa.
Buddham.
Buddham.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Dhammam.
Dhammam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Sangam.
Sangam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Buddham.
Buddham.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Dhammam.
Dhammam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Sangam.
Sangam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Buddham.
Buddham.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Dhammam.
Dhammam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Sangam.
Sangam.
Saranam.
Saranam.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
For the sake of our practice, I vow to refrain from taking life.
I vow to refrain from taking life.
For the sake of our practice.
For the sake of our practice.
I vow to refrain from taking what is not given.
I vow to refrain from taking what is not given.
For the sake of our practice.
For the sake of our practice.
I vow to refrain from sexual misconduct.
I vow to refrain from sexual misconduct.
For the sake of our practice.
For the sake of our practice.
I vow to refrain from telling untruths.
I vow to refrain from telling untruths.
For the sake of our practice.
For the sake of our practice.
I vow to refrain from intoxicating the mind.
I vow to refrain from intoxicating the mind.
And then whatever benefit and merit that we have from our practice together be shared with all beings everywhere. And may all beings be happy. Thank you. Good night. Hey.